Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Tree Action, a human forestry podcast. And I'd like to welcome Emro to Tree Actions. And where are you coming to us from today, Emro?
Thanks, Dwayne. I am coming to you from Olympia, Washington, down here in the old U.S. of A.
Yeah. Olympia. And let's not forget my trusted counterpart, Tony, in Pomeroy, PA. So we got a trifecta, pretty good triangle from Alberta to Washington to Pennsylvania. We've got a pretty wide chunk. We could call it the Tree Action Triangle today. Well, welcome to the show, Emro, and excited to have you on board. We typically, you know, we it's a very informal process, but one thing that we do ask each of our guests as a way of kind of getting us started is we ask them to think about and comment on the first experience that they have recollection of when they felt a connection or an affinity to trees, whenever and however that occurred. So when was the first time you felt a connection to trees? And tell us about
the
that.
First ever. Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in East Tennessee, outside of the Smoky Mountains in the hills. And we had a little neighborhood, and beside our house, there was a vacant lot that was all forested. And it was, I don't know, it was probably a couple of acres. It might have been a few lots. And my brother and I just wandered around in that forest most evenings. You know, mom would be shouting from as far away as she could to, it's dinner time, you know, and we would just be like, there was some old tree stand up there. And so we'd climb up in there and just, you know, romp around in the forest. And I always remember looking back on those times and thinking about, I was so curious about the trees. Why did this one have thin bark and that one had thick bark? And why were the leaves on the sassafras all three different kinds? And why were there needles on these other trees? And why were the leaves shaped differently? And one, some are tall and some are small. You know, just so much curiosity for the differences, the diversity amongst the forest was baffling and intriguing to me. And I always wanted to know more about it. And so I learned more. I'll always be learning more.
Yeah. Wow. So, you know, that childhood fascination, how did it manifest itself into the career that you find yourself now? How did that path go?
I think that curiosity just kept coming up until I was ready to acknowledge it. And it was incessant, you know. I wasn't really ready to acknowledge, oh, this could be a career choice. Like, I didn't think about that. I didn't know any foresters or arborists or really people that worked with trees at all growing up. That curiosity grew in high school. I was getting into hiking and camping a lot, and so spending a lot of time in the forest. And so I thought the only job that existed was like park ranger kind of job. And so I wasn't really interested in that. And so I didn't really know what was out there, but I knew I was really curious about trees. And then I went to college and I thought that I wanted to be a pharmacist for a minute. That was a very odd mental pathway for me. I didn't want to be poor anymore, and I knew they made a lot of money. I think it was the goal there. So I'll be a pharmacist. And so I had to either major in biology or chemistry. And so I majored in chemistry, in biology. And I only got one choice of school because we didn't have a lot of money, and my parents spent all the college fund on my genius brother, which was smart of them. I'm glad they did that. But so I just had one choice of school because my mom always wanted to teach college. She was like, well, I'll teach at this school and you can go there. And I thought, great. Oh my God, I'm going to get to go to college. And they didn't have a forestry program, arboriculture program, or really anything with trees. And so so I went down that pharmacist pathway and majored in biology, which was great because it led me right back to trees. My advisor and professor of a couple of different classes, Dr. Trenum, he was great. He was really into trees and into forests. And so he had a pretty significant bias in many of the environmental science and biology classes that I took that were tree heavy. And so I learned tons about trees through his classes and ended up graduating. And like, I knew by then I wanted to work with trees, but I didn't know, I still didn't know what was out there. You know, I had dated a guy and been some friends with some folks that were on fire crews. So I knew that was a job, but I didn't really know what else was out there. And so there were some folks that said, well, just apply to the Forest Service. You know, there's all kinds of jobs. So I applied to the Forest Service and in a region, I think, and someone called me from Idaho, which was one of the regions I applied for, and said, hey, do you want to come work for us, be a biological technician? And I said, yeah. And I thought that meant like water quality and wildlife studies and stuff like that. And it wasn't at all. It was, I showed up and they said, 95% of your job is going to be identifying and felling hazard trees. And I was like, oh, well, I don't know a lot about that, but cool. And so they taught me and I went from, I can never remember which is class A and which is class C even then, but it went from like the smaller certification to the biggest certification just within a couple of months. It was like a fast track because there were just two of us on this hazard tree crew. And I fell in love with chainsaws. I fell in love with working in the forest. I absolutely loved both, which was a little bit of a juxtaposition in my head, you know, like, how do I love working in the forest, but I also love cutting it down? and it was just trees, hazard trees. So I guess that's, that was my first, like, oh, this is what I want to do. And I didn't even know what all was out there. Like, I didn't know there were tree climbers. I didn't know there were arborists. I didn't know there were people that worked with tree preservation or any of that stuff. And so over the course of the next 7 years or so, I would start to find these things out little by little and figure out, oh my God, those are jobs too.
So what was your first memory of what you would call a successful, or where you felt like you did it, like you were given a tree, it was technical, you did it, you cut it, it, you know, you solved the problem, you got it down or unsnagged or whatever the situation might have been, and you were like, wow, I've finally arrived here. Do you recall a moment like that?
Yeah, I do. Fun question too. So I remember being pretty frustrated for a while. Just it was a steep learning curve, right? You know, just learning how to buck stuff. And my supervisor was really great because he would, every time I'd stick my saw in the dirt, he would make me stop right then and there and sharpen it, the whole thing. And I was like, yeah, this is very annoying, but it also makes sense to me. And out of that, I became a good sharpener. But so I was at a period where I was a little bit frustrated because the learning curve was so steep, right? Like, I'm felling all these big trees. There's decay involved. There's a lot of other trees. There's targets, you know, there's a lot of things. And there was a particular day that he had just had me felling stuff just out kind of in the woods that were threatening trails or campsites or something, but no major infrastructure target. And so I remember this particular day, I don't know, I was probably 3 months into the job. And he said, all right, so here's this bathroom that costs $50,000. And here is this campsite with all this signage, you know, like when you drive into a Forest Service campground, it's got all the signs and like the little wooden thing they build with all signage. So it was between the bathroom and the signs. And he said, all right, you can see that the direction that it's leaning is just a little bit where you want it to go. And so I want you to put it right in between this bathroom and this sign. And I was like, oh my God, there's targets. Like, this is, I was really nervous that I was going to demolish this expensive bathroom with this tree. And, but I just like took all of his instructions and, you know, used felling sights and figured it out and went for it. And it landed perfectly. And I was like, oh, this is fun. This is really fun.
Yeah. And, you know, there's something I think you have to have been, you know, I don't know how I put this, but falling a tree, learning, first of all, learning how, watching it done, because that's part of, I don't know anyone that's used a chainsaw and fell the tree where it hasn't been a mentorship type of process. Whether it's been a long term or short term, there's a period of time where you observe and watch, and then you get opportunity to cut, and then, but at some point you get to that place where it's like, okay. And, you know, you realize, you know, some of the simpler ones, but then there's that one where, you know, you might be on your own and you may or may not realize it, but at some point during it, you realize this is like a really technical thing and I'm by myself, or I'm actually in charge of this and this really could go badly. And you have to draw on all that, those resources. And it's from that point on when you successfully do that, hopefully, that you can start to move forward. You know, I remember the first time I took a course from Tim Ard, who I considered to be my ultimate mentor and really changed my career path in not only instruction, how I taught, but also how I cut. But I, like the week after taking technical tree falling, or it was called precision falling, I was teaching at the college and I was going to make a video of this new technique and this new method that I was exposed to, and involved bore cutting and all the rest of it. It's a lot of what we know now. And I decided to remove this dead spruce tree right beside, you know, and I think back on, I was within my limits of approach, like, so I really shouldn't have been cutting it. It was large for our area. It was one of the largest trees on campus, and it was dying, if not dead. So, like, it had to go, but no one wanted to do it because if it's leaning towards the power lines, triple phase lines across major road right in front of the college, if it wasn't within the limited approach, it was right on the edge. Like, and if it went the wrong way, it was everything bad possible. Like, I probably would have lost my job if it went the wrong way. It was that big of a deal. And I just, and I videoed the whole thing. And this is back when you got to rent the VHS. You got to put it up on the tripod. I had the guy that did the audiovisual stuff at the college, like, video it for me and make a video. Right, like it wasn't like with the phone and all, like the GoPro, right. None of that. This is like 1994, right? So I don't know where that video is. I wish I could find it. But anyway, and I cut the, I stop and talk through every step of the plan. And I think back to that, and I don't know that I'd have the stones to do it today, even what I know now, because it was pretty brazen. But I was confident because of Tim's instruction. And there might have been a couple times in it where I was like, ooh, this really better work. But, you know, and I had to wedge it. Like, I needed a wedge fully. It had to be wedged. It was not going to go the way I needed it. Like, it needed to be, the wedge had to work. And I wouldn't put a line in it. That was the big thing. I could do this without a pole line. So I didn't even put a pole line in it, which was really quite silly. But, you know, that I remember that, like, the way you kind of remember your bathroom incident, right? Or your bathroom tree. But it's really a cool feeling. And I think anyone that's done it can all think back, right, to a time where they, because the feeling of pride and, I don't know, elation, I think is the word that pops to my mind. It's really quite cool, isn't it?
It is really cool. And it's funny, you know, looking back on a handful of years in the beginning, because I learned from this guy in the Forest Service, but then I was pretty on my own, just like a rogue tree cutter working for some companies, but also just like, I mean, at that time in Tennessee, 15 years ago, there weren't a lot of tree care companies. You just like show up and cut people's trees down, you know? And so I look back on those times and I'm like, I found some pictures recently because my brother just passed away. And so I was going through some pictures with my mom when I was home. And there were some pictures from when I was living in Tennessee and felling trees on their farm. And looking back at some of those pictures, no PPE on, none at all. And just like these gnarly looking face cuts that are three quarters of the way into the tree, and looking at these and thinking, God, how did I not, like, how did I make it this far? You know, I'm just like blown away, because you think that you're doing some technical stuff. And in some cases you are, right? You're doing some really technical stuff and you don't even realize the weight of how technical of work and how dangerous of the work that you're doing until you know more and more and more, and you start doing more technical stuff. And I remember several years ago, I was working for state parks, and we would get contracted out to Department of Transportation, and they would contract us for the trees they didn't want to cut. They were like, ooh, those are not, like, we don't want to touch those, so we'll hire you guys to do it. And there were some trees out there that I just, same thing, like you said, elation. Like there's some targets you got to fit. You know, I remember fitting like a 4-foot cottonwood in a 5-foot space between a couple really expensive things, like an attenuator on the road and a light post that both cost a whole bunch of money, and just like just nailing it. And God, that is so rewarding and so fun. And it's fun to look back on like how much I've learned and progressed over the years, and how less stupid I've gotten too about my choices, right? Like I was telling you before we just started, I don't hear as well as I used to because of those few years in the beginning where I didn't have any PPE.
Absolutely.
Went for it.
Yep. Yeah, no, the PPE, I've pictured me doing removals with a bandana and ripped off t-shirt sleeves.
Right.
I have a harness on, but that's it. No lanyard. I mean, the lanyard's there, but it's not engaged, and I'm way out on a limb, you know, lopping off, doing a big removal. A poplar, you know, so tied into, crazy. But, yeah, it is interesting, the one's progression, and I think it's important to remember that, you know, to where you've come from, and that we all have a journey, you know, and that it's a progression, and not to judge too harshly those young folks nowadays, because it comes up on sometimes, you know, the industry is different. I mean, you hear every person say that as they get a little older, you know, like, oh, it's not like it was back in mine. I just did it with the VHS story, right? But there is some similarities too, you know, and how you get into things, and you know, your first time doing anything is always a bit of a learning experience, right? And it can relate to almost anything. But Tony, I'm a little curious if you have, I mean, do you have a first tree where you had that moment of like, poof? We've never talked about that, like in felling particularly.
Yeah, probably, but it was more of a feeling of like, I'm better than the rest of my family is kind of thing. Because, you know, when you grow up and learn in a family business, guilt and shame are training tools. But it's like when I look back at my career, because, you know, working with my father's influence, my older brother, Ben, you know, we were really very fairly advanced for whatever day we were working. Climbing techniques were really advanced, you know, like, but what was really pretty much the standard was our cutting techniques, like felling. We were still, when I first started, you know, this was, you know, common notch, 45 degrees, one third of the way in, step the back cut, just typical stuff, you know, nothing too crazy. And that was always the same. And then when I started to get a little more formal training, went to the Arbor Master course and worked with Ken and Rip, and then learned, you know, these techniques as we know them now, then brought them back. Then I do remember sometimes when I, you know, got away from the common notch and actually did a bore or a plunge cut, and you know, and it goes the right way. And then I remember feeling satisfied, but then I also remember just really wanting to rub it into my brother's face about how much better I was than him at this. So the feelings are a little mixed there, but yeah, there was definitely a sense of accomplishment to doing that. And like Emro said, I too, you struggle with that. Like I like trees, and now people want you to cut trees down, and it's, you know, there were times it's like, why am I cutting down this perfectly good tree? Fortunately, we, you know, being residential, and my brother always, he built the company, the family company, he built it on the fact that we do proper modern arboriculture. And we would turn down a lot of like, I want this, you know, 40 inch oak tree down because it's filling my gutters up with acorns. It's like, not interested in that type of work kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were, you know, we were never going to be. So I was fortunate that I didn't have to, you know, get put in that position a lot. But it is an interesting juxtaposition that you really love to do something terrible to things that you really like. You know, it's like, I like trees and I really do kind of like cutting them down too. Like, you know, they could all be dead, that'd be one thing. But then, like I said, you know, with my philosophy background, I'm like, you know, just because the tree's dead doesn't mean it's useless. Like, you know, pound for pound, there might be more life in that dead tree than, you know, who am I to say that I should be the one that lays it flat onto the ground? So it was always kind of an interesting, you know, removals were always that strange mix of professional and technical satisfaction, but a little bit of bittersweet. Like, I really just took down kind of a nice tree, like because the gutters were dirty, you know, like, oh, my trees are so dirty. You'd be like, yeah, that's why we keep them outside. Yep. Yeah, that's what we do.
That's a good one, Tony. I really used that. Yeah, and that was just a nice period of time in my career. I think when I started my own tree care business and I could make that determination on my own, you know, it wasn't just like, you have to cut this tree down because that's what's on the work order for today. I wrote the work orders, right? And so it was really nice to be able to take that, I don't know if you want to use the word power or control, into your own hands and be able to say and educate folks, you know, residential clients, and say, this is an integral tree to your landscape. Actually, this tree's roots are holding up your steep slope over the bay here. You know, there are actually some significant functions of this tree that you maybe hadn't thought about before. And so it was, you know, I did a lot of removals in the beginning with my company because it was what I was good at. And then it was nice to be able to slowly shift that process from doing a fair bit of removals into, by the time I closed my business, it was, you know, probably like 5% of the work we were doing, 10% maybe was removals, and it was a thriving business. So it was nice to be able to shift that a little bit. Tree preservation is a fun thing to work on too, getting into the pruning and diagnostic work and how do we keep these trees going, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think I'm realizing, I don't remember that we've ever had a session on, we talk often about climbing in our podcast, but we haven't talked a lot about falling. And I don't know if it's like, this is a bit of a question. I want to just foray into this because of your background, Emro, into the Forest Service. And Tony, you're mentioning about the way you originally cut trees. I mean, I was taught also, like for me, I was, what I should finish saying, I was taught also 45 raised back cut, like a third or so. When I took the precision falling course from Tim, first of all, I didn't think I needed it. It was part of the 3-part program. You had to take it to take rigging. I really wanted rigging. It's like, okay, fine, I'll take chainsaw. What do I need to take chainsaw for? It's ridiculous. Like, I genuinely didn't think I was going to learn anything. And I did it because I had to. And I was absolutely blown away by what Tim taught, like opening the notch. I was like, what the hell is that? And then this 80% versus what? What is he talking about? And then watching him, the first time I saw him bore cutting, and he was prepping some trees before the class even started. And I was like, what the hell is he doing? I had never seen it. And I was already teaching at a college. Like, I thought I was like, you know, I was a bag of chips and a, maybe even a donut at that point, right? Like, I know what I'm doing. Like, I'm an instructor. And I felt like, yeah, I didn't know nothing. And I didn't buck him too much. Like, the one thing I couldn't abide was the steering. He said, like, the thin, thick, the tree will, he said, it just doesn't work. And he said, yeah, as long as you don't cut it while it falls, and it doesn't fall for the reason you think if you do that, but think about your positioning. And I was just, and I'll never forget him. He's like, don't believe a word I say, try it for yourself. And I did. I got a contract because I was still doing contract work while I was teaching at the college, and I got this big clearing job, and I tried to make trees steer, and it just didn't, and I couldn't believe it. But the open notch, the percentage of hinge, how much hinge to leave, and then the way to leave it without it going and letting it go when you wanted it to go with the strap and everything. Was that like an epiphany, like a major shift for you guys as well? Like at that stage going like, where the hell did this come from? How come I never seen this before?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. It was, I don't know, let's see, probably like 6 or 7 years, maybe 6 years into felling that I learned that, you know, when I worked for Parks, they hired this person and I can't remember your name now, but they hired this person, not super well known, but really great instructor to come and teach us this plunge cut and, you know, some modern tree felling techniques. And we're like, we're modern. We know what we're doing. We drop big trees all the time, you know. And so we thought we knew what we were doing. What can we learn from this guy? And, you know, as probably all tree people do at some point in their career, they get these big shoulders and they're like, ah, I know everything. And so, oh my God, did that take my confidence level down a whole bunch of pegs, because I wasn't good at it at first. And so I learned this 70 to 90 degree notch and this plunge cut and leaving the trigger in the back. And my mind was blown because I was like, oh, there's a way to get it to not barber chair. That's really cool. Other than wrapping a chain around it, you know, or a yeah, bunch of straps. Like, oh, I yeah, can see yeah, a lot of places that would be really handy and like way less scary.
Yeah.
And then it took me a little bit of time to get it. And so I remember practicing that a lot in our, and one particular instance where it didn't go great. I was injured. I was overconfident and it didn't go well. And that was a huge learning lesson for me. But then I kept at it and it went really well, you know? And so then being able to drop these leaning big leaf maples or cottonwoods or alders and have this confidence of like, that tree's not going to go until you cut the trigger and you're just in whatever position you want to be in when that happens and you're ready for it. And it's just, oh, the amount of yeah, control yeah, and safety and confidence that it built once I got a good handle on it was really mind-blowing and really fun. And then being able to teach that to people a few years later was super yeah, fun, and watching those light bulbs go off for them, like, you know, they, I would see people come in with the same attitude I had. What are you gonna teach me? And then, you teach them that, and they're like, "Oh, well, this is pretty good. This is good."
yeah. Well, and Tony, it sounds like it was similar for you, like based on your what you were saying there.
Yeah, like I said, it's, you know, my felling before I learned these methods was admittedly rather limited. Like, I'd done it for a couple years, but they didn't let me grab the big saw and drop the big trees. I was still a turf groomer, branch manager at that point. And, you know, when it came to firewood for heating the house, you know, I was the wood stacker, wood hauler. But so I had fairly limited, I mean, I thought I was pretty good and it seemed pretty, I think what really changed it for me is when I learned those techniques. And while I didn't learn from Tim, I might as well have, right, from Skip and, or from Rip and, you know, in the Arbor Master programs, like it just, you know what, The way I explain it now, if anyone's ever taken a chainsaw course, is when it comes to felling, it comes to anything, but especially felling, there's principles and there are methods, right? And there's a lot of different methods to fell a tree, but the principle is relatively the same. And the principle of felling a tree is a face cut coupled with a back cut forms a hinge that gives you a reliable performance, right? That's, put it in a sentence, that's what it would be. And I think by learning the bore cut method, by judging, 80% hinge length, all those things, 70 to 90, understanding the three methods, what a face cut is really there for, the three things it does, allowed me to understand the principles of tree felling. And the saying is, that if you understand the principles, you can choose your own methods. But if you only know methods, you're always going to be befuddled, right? So that's, and that didn't really dawn on, I just took Ken and Drip's word and did it that way. And I did the same thing. I'm like, I got to prove it. So I went back after doing the training, and for a couple months, I didn't cut my old way. I didn't do the common notch. And I'm like, you know what? They're right. It works. And that's what I started doing. And I really didn't question it much. And then as I started training more, as people start asking me questions, I realized that's when I really started to understand the difference between a principle and a method. And tree felling is one of those things, like it's the hot button topic, like there's just people, but when people argue about tree felling, they are inevitably arguing about methods, or they're totally wrong and they don't understand the principles. Like I've run into logging crews, I shit you not, they were hired because they were able to fell trees accurately. And their felling method was basically a snap cut at the base. Yeah. And they got the skidder cable as high as they could. And they drove as fast as they possibly could. And they were pulling Woods oak tree down. Probably the biggest might have been 18 inches, but they were 75 feet tall next to my buddy's house. And he's like, I'm like, oh my God. Like, I can't believe they did it. I can't believe they did it totally. They would get the skidder cable as high as they could, which was about 18 feet if they stood on top of the arch, and they would get it up there, and then they would take out as much cable out as they could. They had one wrap left because you don't want that cable coming off. And literally they used a snap cut, and it was actually backwards because the low cut was on the backside. So they weren't even doing the snap cut right. And then the skidder operator must have just, he put a little bit of slack in the cable and he hit the gas and he went. And it just, it was all gravity at that point. And I'm like, so, of all the things in arboriculture that people debate, felling, tree felling is one that, it's absolutely insane. And there's a whole, when you get up to where Emro's at in the PNW, telling somebody not to make a home bolt is basically dishing their religion. Like just saying, your religion is shit and you're a piece of crap and your family's a piece of shit and you all suck. I mean, they react that way. It's like, oh my God.
People hold on.
It's like, all I said was maybe you might not want to make a home bolt cut,
This is an appropriate moment for that.
And they're, oh my God. And then God forbid you said, I've had, how many people, Emro, have told you that bore cutting is unsafe?
Quite a few.
It is downright point blank unsafe.
Well, you got to use the tip of the saw, right? Like that's dangerous, they say. And that alone was an epiphany. Like how basic a thing is reactive forces. And yet I had never had anyone ever explain how a chainsaw cuts, number one, and the reactive forces. Like you feel them and they're there, but I had never, and I realized I know exactly how kickback happens now, and thereby I know how to avoid it. Like it's so simple, and yet all I was ever taught is don't use the tip. It's dangerous. But that person clearly that taught me didn't know how or what happened, and Tim just happened to be the first person. See, in the early days, Tim brought all the chainsaw techniques to Arbormaster, right? And he taught Ken and Rip. And he was part of the team for quite a while, but there was a parting of ways between Ken and Tim early on and then Ken and Rip just kept on, but they never deviated from, and interestingly is all of that training came out of Game of Logging, which had come out of Sweden originally with Soren Eriksson's program. And it was, originally, oddly enough, brought around through the logging industry in Sweden, particularly. And you talk to people in Europe and they'll call it the Swedish method. Hey, okay? And they have it in there too. Like I assume that in Europe, everyone does it this way, but no, you can go to particularly like the, I think of the Czech Republic, some guys up there, and they're like, oh, you use the Swedish method, right? Or they wouldn't talk that way. But anyways, you know what I mean? And even there is dissension. It is the most controversial descended technique and form of arboriculture. And even when I think back to myself, like I was willing to learn climbing and rigging techniques because, you know, you're off the ground and all that. But my God, I could certainly fell a tree. Like who can't do that? Like even the biggest, most out of shape guy that can run a sock and by God fall a tree and I'm proud of it. Right. So don't take my Kodachrome, they don't want that piece taken from them because they may have lost their fitness and ability to climb. They don't run the bucket, but don't tell me how to cut a tree. You know, I think that's part of where it comes from. And you got to really carefully, you know, approach those people with this. Like I can imagine people listening to this podcast, some of them might be like, what the hell? You know, we're like these open-faced zealots, you know, but when I learned that the hinge, you know, preserving the hinge, that the hinge actually functions from here to there in the whole 45, that the hinge has to break, I was like, yeah, wow. That, and when I thought about it, and the other thing that happened to me was I had a tree go on a tin shed. It was one of the first trees I ever felled. And I was given it, I realized now, because everyone knew it was going to happen and no one wanted to be the responsible for it. But they had also budgeted already. It was an accepted attrition that was going to happen. So it was kind of like a joke learning curve thing. And if I had known about open face notch and a bit about using sights, it was totally avoidable. But the people I was learning from didn't even know. So like this was the tree I got to do my first fell on, them knowing it's going to flatten the tin shed and that I'm going to not only learn how to fall trees on my own, but I'm going to learn how to fix sheds because that's important too. You know, and it was literally, that was the learning process I realized now. And it's like, holy cripe. Like, and I think it's that way for a lot. Like, honestly, like it's just part of the job. Like Scott Prophet would always make jokes about Jasper, you know, his alter ego saying it's important. Training is important. You got to learn how to fix eaves troughs and replace shingles. You definitely need to know that.
Yeah.
It's kind of a joke.
And running, right? Running
not used to be a
skill in tree felling, right? Like that, when I was learning for many years, like you got to be able to run. Like you got to make sure that like you don't have like your chaps or your pants aren't like caught up on something, like because you got to be able to run, right? Because that was like there wasn't a lot of prediction and control in the methods that we were using. And so then like learning the plunge cut and learning those skills and learning like, oh, my hingewood has so much control. Like that's where all of the control actually lies. And learning those skills, you know, it turns out that if you're running in tree felling or in arboriculture practices at all, shit's not going right. It's not happening the way that you want it to. And so that was a weird technique, you know, it was just like cut and run, right? Like literally.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. It made me think of like a bomb disposal guy. Like if the bomb disposal guy's running, you better run.
Exactly. So learning that control and then when I became an instructor and teaching those things, like Tony said, that helped me learn everything so much more in depth. Like, well, why is this like this? Oh, well, let me think about that.
I had a kind of an epiphany moment too. I guess it would have been 2018, 2019 when I first met Svante. Svante Hansen, right? And I always tell people learning chainsaw from Svante is like learning martial arts from Bruce Lee. Like you're right at the root of it there, right? You know, pun intended. Yeah. But he basically told me the story of, you know, Svorn Eriksson is generally credited with this cutting technique and the Swedish method and all that. But when he described to me where it came from, it just made a world of sense and it was an epiphany moment. But basically, the methods were developed for forestry in Sweden. And the vast majority of forestry of cutting is conifers, so single stem conifer trees. And being that they're a lot like Germans and they like to be very precise. So they wanted to know, you know, where are they spending most of their time cutting and how can they improve that? So they determined just by sheer time that they spend like 75 to 85% of their time limbing. right? So that's when they run a chainsaw, 85% of the time they're cutting limbs off the tree. So felling is only 10, you know, and the, another 5% is just clearing. And then so felling's like just, you know, so they developed a felling method. They would keep the trunk, the hinge intact, so it would stay on the cut so that it was easier to limb conifers. It just happens that it's a really safe method to fell trees. It just, they didn't, it was according to Svante, and I'm taking his word for it, when they were working through these things in the 70s, the idea was just to make logging in Sweden easier. And the best way to do that was to make it easier to limb a tree. So they developed this method to make it easier to limb a tree. And when you tell people that and they're like, wait a second, this didn't have anything to do with safety. I'm like, no, it didn't. And then for some reason, now they want to believe it more, right? Like they just like, ah, oh. So it's not just about being safe. It's about being more efficient. I'm like, that's what we call a win-win.
And right? Watching Svante do the limbing dance is just, it's like watching poetry in action. He's such a smooth chainsaw operator.
Yeah. And it works great until you drop an oak on the East Coast. Then it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. <You know?
laughs> It works really good on conifers and single stem. Yeah. At a certain height. But I mean, but I really value teaching that method because what it offers, what it opened up for me was the different ways I can hold the saw and keep it on the wood and reduce like having to hold it above, like supporting the entire weight of the saw. And I mean, that's something else that becomes more apparent as your not only hearing goes, but your strength and stamina with just age, you know. And I'm not out of shape, but I definitely feel the effects of a chainsaw while I'm living and bucking more than I did when I was 30. Right. Like I just do. But I can still do it. And using, you know, I remember I got injured in a car rollover and I really hurt my elbow. And I had to modify my climbing methods, tree climbing, because I couldn't pull with the one arm in the same way. So that's, and I had a Pantene right when they first came out. I'd had it for a long time, a couple of years, and they weren't really catching on. It, you know, SRS wasn't a thing. But I hurt my arm, and then I had this thing in my bag, and I was like, oh, you know what? And I started using it on the tail of my line, because I couldn't pull anymore. So I had to use something else to overcome this limitation. And, you know, it wasn't an age thing there. It was an injury thing. But you realize that there's easier, different ways. You use different muscle groups and so on. And sometimes you're forced into it. And age is one of those things. And that's what I've appreciated about that technique, Tony, regardless of whether it applies in every situation. But it offers me more options of how to do something, right? You know, and my understanding of that study, and I should ask sponsors specifically, was it was also the first time that it had been researched by engineers. Like it wasn't just guys in the forest trying to figure it out. They had people with training to actually measure it and realize how to make it work. So like it was like, let's cut. Well, I'll try cutting the notch different. It was like, well, let's see how this works. And that, to my knowledge, was one of the first times like someone with that type of background researched the method that was being used and how would you keep it on the stump. And my understanding was that it was partly due to safety as well, because there was a lot of accidents happening and it was commissioned by the government to be, and that's where the techniques came out of. And it was in that time frame you're speaking of, but it had a two-prong approach, because there's no way the king is going to invest in just safety.
Right.
It's got to make money too.
There's
right?
No money in
and
that.
I choose to believe it was two pronged, but I don't have confirmation from Svante like you do on that.
Data driven tree felling. It was
epiphany. It was, and it's funny to me because it came from logging, you know, and it was brought through the back door through Husqvarna to ArborMaster, which was a fledgling organization training arborists that really all of us were born out of. And all of the companies that run today that teach it, you know, have some connection back to the ArborMaster group. And it's had quite a, I think, even more of a powerful impact on the arborist industry, specifically in North America, even more so than in Europe, which I find just really interesting how that pattern has gone. I don't know, Tony, if you have observed that, but thought about that.
Yeah, I think like the first time I'd really heard of it before I did the Arbor Master program is when it was still, and it still exists now, the Game of Logging. You'll still run into Game of Logging instructors, but a lot of my, I have a dear friend of mine who at that point when Game of Logging was coming over, Soren Erickson, this would have been the 80s, he was logging. Yeah. He was a logger in Massachusetts, Northern Pennsylvania, and they called it the Swedish game of dicking around in the woods, which I just thought was hilarious. But I mean, to this day, they were all using the methods. They just couldn't give them serious credit. They just had to make fun of them because that's what they do. But yeah, so, and I still get inquiries to this day, you know, for chainsaw training, like, oh, do you teach the game of logging methods? And I can honestly say, yeah, I do. I mean, there's some differences. I think Game of Logging did a lot more on the maintenance and sharpening as a course. Yeah, yeah. And they also did a lot more with wedges. The chainsaw training that I tend to do now is much more arboricultural, residential related. And that's the other thing I think people kind of get confused too. When you're a logger, you know, your margin of error is larger, generally speaking, for property damage. As a residential arborist, you know, if it goes 3 foot wrong and it lands in the pool, it's over, man. You know, like I'm making no money and I'm losing money. Whereas if it hangs up in a, you know, it's beyond the safety aspects, there's an efficiency aspect that really, you know, you have to fell differently in Mrs. Smith's front yard than you do on 120,000, you know, acre logging cut. You just do, you know, because it, and out there I can like, oh, it's going to hit that tree. Well, I'll cut that tree down first. Like, well, I can't move Mrs. Smith's pool. You know, I've asked and they wouldn't let me. So I couldn't.
Well, we're a lot of the way into this podcast and we've only talked about tree felling. I feel like there's many other avenues we could go down. That's not all I've done in the world, everyone. But it is a fun subject. It's getting me fired up, actually. I haven't run a chainsaw in a pretty long time, and I'm like itching now.
Well, and you know, I'm honest. I don't think we've yet had an episode where we've touched on the whole falling thing, and I think it's important, and it's a huge part of arboriculture. Like you guys said, we're into tree preservation, and as arborists, it seems counterintuitive to think that but you know, all arborist companies at some point you have to become good at removing trees. It's just part of what we get asked to do. And yeah, we often talk people out of it, and that's a cool thing we get the opportunity to do. And we can even refuse to do it knowing some other one's going to put the blade to it. But
it is a huge part of our industry. And I think it's one that's overlooked a lot, you know. Like, especially as I got more into arboriculture and less into hazard tree felling, it was that there's so much importance put on the role of climbing, right? And then when I would teach chainsaw classes, I would find that it turns out we're not actually as good at running chainsaws as we are at climbing in most cases, you know? And that was the opposite for me because I was running chainsaws for several years before I ever climbed a tree. And so it's interesting that we don't put as much emphasis on it in so many aspects of the work that we do. And like meeting an arborist that's a really good chainsaw sharpener is rare, you know, or like a really, really excellent precision feller is kind of rare. And it's also just something that we don't get an opportunity to do as much of in residential arboriculture either. Just like felling a whole tree, you know, there's not always room for that. So
it is probably the only skill in arboriculture where absolutely the ends justifies the means, right? It doesn't, as long as it hits the ground and nobody gets hurt or nothing gets broken, however you get it there is absolutely usually considered acceptable. That's not true in any other aspect of climbing, right? Like if somebody was climbing without a lanyard, right? You would seriously question them, right? And you could safely, you could climb without a lanyard and not, you know, you should have a lanyard when you climb, but the ends would never justify the means. You would stop that person and correct them. You would say, you need to put a lanyard on. I don't care if you use it, you're going to have it. But with felling and tree, especially tree felling, the ends will always justify the means in most people's minds, right? And it is the one thing that we cut as an industry, we cut that amount of slack to, and we don't cut it anywhere else. And it's always been a mystery to why that is.
Well, not only that, you think about the injuries, and not just injuries, but fatalities that occur in that. And the other place where I think it really is overlooked, particularly the accuracy and the mystique around notching, is taking tops or rigging chunks. It's just, there's no, you know, the Humboldt, for some reason, rules, like it's just, oh, that's the only way to make it go flat. And like, it's just, and you want to talk about dispassionate, holy moly, or passionate, like it just gets amplified 900%. It seems like when you start talking about tops in particular, you know, then it can get, you know, you get down the road into crane pick cuts and all this, which are all variations of felling, right? But, and I remember that was a big thing in the rigging class, you know, where the way we used to teach it, we've deviated a bit from it because we've modified curriculum, but like being really particular on the accuracy of the cut. But when you're taking a 5-foot chunk, you know, and your hinge wood has to be thinner anyway, and then if you overcut it a bit, and it's just like your consequences are somewhat more forgiving. But I still think it's an opportunity to adhere to, I don't know what, that precision and technical accuracy should still prevail regardless of what you're cutting, you know. But even that, the selection of what you choose to cut, the depth of the notch can, you know, I remember, you know, we realizing like you're taking a 6-foot hunk of 36 inch fir or 40 inch fir, you got a big saw, like you need to cut your notch a little deeper just to create a different pivot point. So you're not pushing your back out, trying to shove it over, you know, if you're trying to rig it or tip it. Like you, there's these rooms for adjustments that I don't think gets a lot of, I don't know, even in our programs, I think there's room for it, but it's really quite localized and specialized. But then the same excuses get applied to falling. I don't know. I'm kind of getting lost in my own words here, but I don't know if I'm making any sense. Have you observed that in your travels?
Well, I like what you said about, you know, the opportunity for adhering, I would say, to excellence, right? Like everything is an opportunity, you know, and I would be out working with a bunch of guys on my crew, and they're like, well, it doesn't matter where it goes, really, you know, we're just out in the woods. But if you're not taking that moment to practice an exceptional looking hinge with exactly the amount that you had planned on, you know, you make a plan, right? And then you work the plan, right? And so you, right, learn that from you guys. And if you're not taking that opportunity to make it as great as you can and fell it with exact precision as much as is possible, then it's a wasted opportunity. And when that moment comes around where it really matters, you know, when you're putting it between the $50,000 attenuator and the $30,000 light post, you're not going to be able to do it if you're not taking all of those opportunities, right, to do it well when it doesn't matter. So I appreciate you pointing that out. And
well, it reminds me of the how you do anything, right?
It's how you do everything, right? Yep. Exactly. Yeah.
Tony, what do you think about the cutting tops versus like in the relation to felling? And do you find that it's a bit more dysregulated even within, like we don't have a specific program on that. We do teach it, but how much do we emphasize the significance and variances up there?
I think that there's a lot of methods that could go. The principle remains the same. When you look at actual techniques that have been proven either anecdotally through time or through some type of scientific study, the things you can actually do to reduce forces when throwing a top are relatively simple and easy to do. We know from our talk with, when we talked with Matt Follett, you know, just leaving a couple branches beneath it for force dampening is huge, right? And then, you know, he just recently completed that study on notch angle and stuff like that. And it's just, I don't think your notch angle and everything has as much to do with it as people credit it for. I'm not saying it's ineffective or doesn't do anything. I think that how you choose to cut it can play a big role in it. but I don't think it gives as much credence as people give it. And I'm almost, it doesn't, you know, getting a log to land flat has nothing to do with notch angle, has everything to do with gravity and the space it travels. That's if it's just a log, not with brush on it. So yeah, I think it has a role. I don't think it needs to be. I think that from a training standpoint, we're better off focusing on things that we know work, like leaving a couple branches below for mass dampening, mm-hmm. you know, not stripping the whole thing up, then throwing a big top, making an accurate cut. I think is an accurate cut is probably more important than any specific cut. Mm-hmm. Whatever you cut, you make should be accurate. If you're overcutting past the center of gravity, there should be a reason for that. Mm-hmm. You know, your cut should just be, well, I always, this is just what I do.
Exactly.
You know, so I think that's the, I'm not saying it's unimportant. I think focusing on other, you know, if most people would just focus on a better pre-climb, pre-rig inspection, a lot of accidents and incidents it would be averted, you know, regardless of the cuts you make, right?
True.
And I don't think there's enough focus on tree dynamics and risk assessment. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's enough focus on compartmentalization. I don't think the average arborist out there blowing tops arguing whether or telling me the Humboldt's the best thing ever has a basic understanding of tree compartmentalization and how trees and wound would form and how they strengthen themselves against gravity and wind. And understanding those things, I think, is far more important than arguing over what notch you're going to cut.
Yeah.
It's like pruning. I think, you know, made me think of pruning, you know, it's, you know, making that final cut and how you make that cut's pretty important, you know, and it's how much you cut and how you make the cut versus, I had an epiphany moment and then I lost it, but it, you know, I think you're right. There is a lot of time put into very specific things without the consideration of a more broad scope. And, you know, as long as you have a plan and a reason, I think that's the biggest thing I find. That's what I always try to explain to guys, like at least understand if you're going to use, for example, a 45 on a big top and you know that is going to impart the greatest wavelength down the tree. When that has to close, the hinge has to break, and it causes that launch, which may be what you're looking for. But just know what it's going to do to the rest of the tree that you're tied to. As long as you know that and you've built it into your plan and you've considered that it's able to handle it, then you're making a decision based on an understanding. You're not just, well, that's what I always cut. Because you see so much of that. Like, and then, you know, repetition, the repetitive complacency, it breeds a lot of contempt and I think is a root cause of a certain amount of accidents because it's just the way you always do it. It's not why you do it. It's kind of like what you were talking about, Emerald, like why do we cut the notch this way, not just we cut the notch this way.
Right, exactly. It's the why behind what we're doing, right? That's so critical. I remember being in a philosophy class in college and they're asking, you know, why, right? Like, why do you do it this way? Tell me why. And it's like playing devil's advocate with two different students in the class, like, but tell me why you're doing it like that. And I remember the kid's response being, well, because that's what my dad believed and that's what his dad believed. And I think that felling more than anything else in the tree care industry is so like that, right? I do this because this is what my mentor or my dad or my whoever person showed me how to do this. It's not because this is the latest research. And this is what says that this is going to be the safest method and the most effective method for this particular situation. And so now I think there are many of us thinking a lot more of that. Well, this is the latest research and that's why I do it this way. Like that's what I base my entire career off of these days, right? Mm-hmm. And a big reason why I've gotten involved in writing the Tour de Trees and the Tree Fund, because we base our careers and the decisions that we make every moment of every day off of that research that exists, whether now it's in urban forestry that I'm working in now or in arboriculture, in climbing, in tree risk assessment, in you know, trees in construction, in felling, anything. It's all based on the best research that exists. And I hope that we are all starting to shift more in that direction.
Yeah, I think it's probably the greatest lesson to impart that any instructor can give a student, and that is the lesson of openness and willingness to hear and to adjust and to learn. You know, that's the most powerful and most difficult lesson to impart, you know, because we even have our own ideas, and I have to be careful about myself, because this is the way I learn, and this, you know, and I really believe fervently in a method or a technique, and it doesn't mean that I'll change my mind, but I need to be open to looking and seeing and wondering, well, okay, maybe let's just listen to this. Because as soon as you start closing that off, that's when you start doing exactly what you're talking about. You know, you're just not, you can't learn from the research. You can't accept that if it's just, you get in that mindset. And that's what you teach your students in your class, is how you respond to questions and even how you communicate your lesson. You know, and I'll never forget it, getting back to Tim. You know, I never had heard another teacher ever say this. And he said it at least once, maybe only twice, but I'll never forget it. And it was, don't believe a word I say. Mm-hmm. And I was like, who the hell says that? Why? You know, and it bothered me kind of. But he's like, he was saying, like, try this, you know, try it for yourself. Like, I'm telling you, but try it and see if it works. Like, see what works for you. And, you know, and went so far as to, you know, to this day, if you, like, he's always, he's open and he explains. And that's, I think, one of the greatest lessons he taught me and that I've continued to pass on, is giving people the credit to, like, bringing in what you got here, what you came with is what you came with, and it's valuable and important. You know, your knowledge thus far is who you are, and it's not to say, look, throw everything away, we're going to start fresh. No. We're gonna bring it in the mental toolbox. He told that story, how you never throw away all those little tools, and you never throw away all your old fishing hooks, and you just add them to the tackle box, and that's your brain, right? And what a great way, you know. I think it's probably the most profound lesson that important for instructors to remember. And whenever you hear, I try to remember myself. Whenever I hear myself saying, "Nope, this is the way. That's how you do it." You know, that one example I gave of the big wood thing, and I remember it was someone that had enough patience with me, unfortunately, because I just didn't have a place for this idea of maybe shifting the pivot point on a spar piece, like on a chunk being in it, whether it being rigged, because it's big and heavy, and just to get it to tip. But I was like, but what about barbers? And he's like, well, it's 7-6 feet long. It's not... there isn't enough energy to barber chair it, right? And I'm like, okay, well, but, and all I was doing was not being open. But, and then you're absolutely right, John. It's like, well, wait a minute, don't ever try to fall a 120-foot fir like that, which guys do, but then it goes right back to what we're talking about. You got to have a plan for the whole thing, and it's all got to have a reason for it. And the cookie cutter way of doing anything gets, I don't know. It's hard, and you have to keep it in your fervent, like you were saying, Emeron. I appreciate that. Like, it's every opportunity to improve or to learn, right? Just take it, because it keeps it does something. There in that lies the lesson.
Yeah, and keeping an open mind. You know, like you said, growth only happens in an open mind. And it's funny. I've been kind of looking back on my career thus far, the past 15 years or so, and thinking, God, I just feel like I know so little now, you know, like the more I learn, the less I feel like I know about any one topic, because your mind opens all of these doors to all of these new spaces that you didn't know about before. And then you think, oh my God, well, I didn't realize there were all of these components that go into this one thing. And so it's even become like a conundrum to me about, well, where do I go next in my career? Because I've gotten extremely passionate about all these different things. Like, I would love to be a forest pathologist. Like, diseases in trees are so interesting to me. So interesting. And the more I learn about that, the less I really feel like I know. And, you know, and instruction is my greatest passion. And whether it's chainsaw classes or pruning classes or tree risk assessment or, you know, anything like that, it's just so fun to teach because you learn so much more. And yeah, so it's interesting to think back, and I thought that I knew so much 2 years in and now 15, 16 years in, I know so much less than I felt like I did then.
The greater our knowledge increases, the greater our ignorance unfolds, I think is how Kennedy said it.
Exactly. Yeah.
I saw Tony's eyes light up when you mentioned the philosophy class.
Yeah, I know that's where I am, Tony T.
Well, you know, that there's a term for that when you're constantly questioning something. Why? In philosophy, that's called reductio ad absurdum, right? So you keep questioning something until it either makes sense or it falls apart, right? So if you can reduce it to the absurd, then you've proved a point, right? It wasn't really just a conversation about tree felling, Emro. It was a conversation about cognitive dissonance, right?
You're right.
And how we learn. And, because when you are teaching somebody, no matter what that skill is, you have to overcome that dissonance. Like when I teach somebody, you know, a open face felling method, and it directly contradicts what their grandfather taught them. Mm-hmm. I'm basically asking them to say everything that their grandfather told them is not correct. And that's for some people never quite overcome that, right?
Definitely.
You see that in the tree world all the time because people take trees for granted, especially in the urban environment. Like, just plant another one. But you don't understand that it's going to take 100 years for it to even come close to what that one is, right?
Yeah. It's just my soul. Yes. And now I work in urban forestry right now. And that's been such a challenge for me to hear, you know, trees and sidewalks are one of the most common things that I discuss with folks these days are the relationship between trees and sidewalks and the roots, you know, and the standard method is, well, cut it down and plant more. And that's just very unacceptable to me because that doesn't get you the aged forest, you know, and there's so many benefits in the trees that the older they are, the more ecosystem services they're providing, right? And so it's just such a, open your mind to other possibilities that exist, you know, and there are so many other methods for dealing with trees and sidewalks than just cutting them down and starting over. And I think that the people that have those belief systems have maybe never gotten the opportunity to take a walk through an old growth forest, you know, and certainly never climb an old growth tree and realize how valuable, important, incredible, energizing, you know, just amazing these trees get to be when they are a few thousand years old. That was some of the work that I got to do about a year ago, year and a half ago, was climb some of these old growth trees for research and for cone collection. And that completely changed the direction of my career. I just was like, how do I spend more time preserving, proliferating these species? And trees are amazing. You guys know that. Incredible.
Yeah. The whole concept of contempt prior to investigation, there's a quote on that, right? That it gets a real problem and very easy to do. And, there's a program out there that talks about honesty, willingness, and open-mindedness, and that's how it works, right? And honesty, open-minded, and willingness spells how. and for me, it's, you know, honesty with yourself about things you don't know. That's a big step for a lot of people. It was for me. You know, even in that first course with Tim, I had to honestly face it. I don't know. And I thought I did, but I didn't even really investigate, you know, and then to be open to say, okay, And, you know, him inviting me enough by saying, try it for yourself, and honoring that I brought techniques with me that, you know, brought me thus far. And then, you know, open-minded to try and being willing to give it a shot, like you said, Tony. And it's pretty key elements to, it's part of how you investigate rather than just contempt or ignorantly decide not to.
Yeah. Right? Keeping that open mind and finding that place of growth is also what, like you were said to, you were saying, Tony, the methods versus principles, right? Like when you start to understand the principles, that opens up the space for being able to be creative, right? And to think on your own about it. Well, is this going to work based on what I know about the principles of this tree felling or tree climbing or whatever it is?
The method is the wheel works, and you can build a machine that'll make it easier to roll from here to there. You just have to paint it your color. And you can put one wheel or six wheels or whatever, but you're using a wheel, and you're going to use it to get somewhere, get a job done, but you're just going to, you know, you're not going to reinvent the damn wheel. You're just going to configure it, right? There's a principle and a method, right?
Well, it doesn't matter what kind of wheel you use. It still works the same way. All wheels work the same way.
Right. Yeah.
Some are big, some are small, some, you know, in conjunction. So it goes back and forth. I just, you know, when it comes to urban forestry and trees and sidewalks, I just find it amazing that people will value a slab of concrete that takes about 20 minutes to pour.
Yeah.
More than people will value a tree that might take 30 or 40 years to grow to the point it's at. And they're like, we'll just cut it down and plant a new one. It's like,
no, that's not how this has to work. We just have to think outside the box a little bit, not even a lot. There are books on it, you know? Yeah. You just have to kind of read a book and look at, there are these bridging methods and there are you know, there's so many other methods. Why are we so devoutly holding on to these? Well, this is just how we do it. We just cut the tree down and we replace the sidewalk. Exactly. This is how we do it.
It applies in a lot of other areas besides tree falling, notching. This concept.
Absolutely.
And when you were talking about when you said trees and sidewalks, I'm like, man, if there ever was an oxymoron, there it is, right?
I know. But if we just open up our minds a little bit to how we're doing it, they're not that incompatible, right? It just... maybe using some different materials and maybe doing, changing our methods just a little bit. Yeah.
Changing that it doesn't have to be a straight line.
Exactly. Whoa. I worked on this consulting project once and I said, well, why don't we get the sidewalk to meander around the root systems? And they were like, whoa. You mean not make it a straight line? I said, yeah, that's what I'm proposing. And we did it. And it turns out they told me that people would walk, they wouldn't follow the sidewalk. They would just walk in a straight line. And I was like, that's preposterous. And so we ended up doing the meandering sidewalk. And it turns out people walk on the meandering sidewalk. They don't just walk in a straight line. That was the oddest thing I'd ever done.
I'd like to see a river that grows like a sidewalk or flows like a sidewalk. You know, there's nothing in nature like that. Like, and even any game trail, any path that's made by humans, even where there isn't one prior, that where people walk on a routine basis going to get water or wherever it is, it's never straight. It's just never straight. We don't move that way. So it's just ironic, you know, and that's, you know, talking about engineers and arboriculture or tree felling, you know, that yet, you know, we make a straight line on the notch and we are pretty adhere to that, but yet we have these other areas where we compromise. And I think it's important, but very few things in nature have right angles, if any.
And,
why we keep applying that concept to almost everything is really bizarre.
It is bizarre. It's really bizarre.
You know, it's even interesting. You know, it's part of the reason why there's such a conundrum over the notching, you know, that how wide or how far in, because you're dealing with a curve and a straight line. You're trying to meld them, right? Interesting. Well, you mentioned at the start of the call how it's going to go. We never know. It's part of what makes it fun, I think, for Tony and I. But it also we're entering our second season now, and we've had some feedback as far, you know, from potential guests and others, like, you know, to have some sort of formality to it in certain areas. And I don't need to go into any details, but, and it wasn't that we didn't consider them. We've been open to the concept, but we keep coming back to this model of letting it flow, you know, getting like talking about a river here, you know, the conversation starts with a little flow of water, and then it bumps into whatever. And we have this meandering conversation with people that, you know, like one of our guests called them, how pleasant it was to have a meaningful, intelligent conversation. And I like to think that's what we're having. And I hope people continue to want to listen to it and find it interesting to listen to as much as we enjoy having the conversations. So thanks for being willing to just go on this meandering river-like conversation.
I said, I have another question, though. You ready?
Oh, yeah.
So if you could have a billboard anywhere and the whole world could read it, so you have the hypothetical billboard, whole world's going to read it, what would it say?
Oh, wow. I could go so many directions with that. Probably the bumper sticker, trees are the answer. Because the more work I do in urban forestry and the more work I do in arboriculture, I just find that to be so true. Trees are the answer, right? You know, they are responsible for a lot of the air that we breathe, then the shade that keeps us cool, and filtering water and reducing flooding, and, you know, so many other benefits that they provide. And we just keep coming back to this, like, well, trees are the answer. And you look at Meg Laumann's work, you know, and the countries that she's been in, and looking at the deforestation that's happening, and trees really are the answer when you look at what happens when you remove them all, you know, and you're left with 2% forest cover. It's not a good situation. So, yeah, that's.
Well, and not only that, the premise of the podcast, like the human forest, like the one example of what is possible if we were to live in harmony like forests do. I think if we could grasp that concept better as a civilization or as a society, as a human race, like it would be a better place, I think, you know, and trees have the answer to that, I think, as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, what if we acted as if the connections in the mycelial network, you know, the mycorrhizal network, rather, where we give one another what we need and warn each other a bit about things that are coming and just stay connected and support one another, have this connection like the forest does, and are able to also bend and move around in the wind and be more flexible, you know, not so rigid in our thinking, and opening our minds to this growth like we were talking about before. I just think that's so
exactly
necessary.
To me, the mycelial network and those things that the forest are give us a metaphoric example of what we could be like energetically, spiritually. You know, I think there's that's the metaphor that I draw, or the symbolism I draw on that. And, you know, it's part of the reason I like to call this the Human Forestry Podcast. Because it's we're sharing soulful energy in a mycelium like way, right? And hopefully helping others gain and learn something and getting energized by just listening. You know, that's our medium of I don't know what would be an example in trees, but I think of you know, the mycorrhizal connections that occur in the neural network, the mycelial networks, and the fibrous network that exists underground that we're developing energetically and spiritually through.
Absolutely. And you think about like Suzanne Simard's research and the mother trees that exist that, you know, support those other ones. Like, that's what I think about, you know, my amazing friends and mentors in the industry. Like, you guys are some of my favorite tree people. And you're like the grandfather trees, right? Where you're supporting all of, not in age, but in experience, you know, and in how strong you are in the industry and the pillars of just amazing work and skill and support that you have for the other little seedlings that are coming up in the forest around you. You know, it's just... it's wonderful to see that and to be connected to folks like you in those experiences and just be tapped in like that mycorrhizal network of just connection and, and, you know, Svante and people all over the world that are feeding the rest of us standing on your shoulders in some ways and also being connected in our root systems, right?
Yep. And feeding one another. Absolutely. Yep. Yep. That's pretty much it. I think it's a good example of it. You bet. Tony, how do you like that? A grandfather, your grandfather, Tony?
I was pulling more for like uncle, maybe. I'm not feeling grandfather.
All right. Yeah. Uncle trees. You're the uncle trees.
Uncle. Yeah. It's okay.
I realize that it's just my own vanity, but you know, I'm struggling. It's not easy getting ready.
It's okay.
There's so many metaphors for it, right? And I think that I think the connections between humans do exist. That, you know, like the mycelium, I just don't think that we've either lost touch with them or we just choose to ignore them. And in many cases, but I think you can come back to it. And I think there's, Nick said that the human forestry part of it is huge. And the more that, you know, my professional career and it, you know, trees, I'm trying to learn to look at legacies and what a legacy is the way a tree looks at it.
Mm.
Because, you know, like, you know, Dwayne referred to it, you know, my favorite Neil deGrasse Tyson quote is one of the most powerful things you can do in this world is to launch another learner into it. And to do that requires a certain amount of legacy. And it's always been a kind of a struggle, like, how do you leave a legacy behind? And I think that the examples right there, I think trees and forests are showing us that. You just have to choose to see it and to go that way.
Absolutely. And understand that, you have to choose to see it. I think that's well said, Tony. You know, there's been a lot of periods of time in my career where before I would climb a tree, I would walk up to it and put a hand on it and just connect with it and just ask it what it needs, you know? They always talk to me when I'm up there, right? So when you do that, you know, when you take that time to make that connection and ask what the needs are, whether it's the person in front of you or the tree that you're working on or in, it's just taking a moment to connect with what's right there and ask what the needs are and say, hey, what can I do for you? How can I support you? And I think that's critical, whether it's in our human dealings or in our forest dealings or in our urban forest dealings.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's what I consider a pre-climb inspection now, right? I used to call it a pre-climb inspection. I'd walk around the tree 360 degrees looking for hazards and all those things. Now I just go up and say, hey, how's it going? Still looking for all the same things, but I'm having a little more of a conversation now.
Right. Exactly.
And it just changed it. And it just, you know, and sometimes I think another valuable lesson that, you know, has just recently occurred to me in the last couple months is that, you know, trees don't really need us to fix them. We just need to, you know, meld them into the world. And I think that's a lesson that I wish I could have learned much earlier in life, that, you know, I can't fix everybody. And sometimes they don't even need fixed. I just needed to be there and spend time with them. So
exactly. I think that trees and people alike don't need to be fixed. We just need to be loved. And I think that's very important to open our eyes to, you know, that we don't need to try and fix one another. There is no fixing because we're not broken in the first place.
It kind of reminds me of, I think, firstly of elephants and horses, but then even pets, you know, dogs, cats, even, you know, like where you have a, you don't have a language. Obviously there's eye contact. So then there's a heartbeat and there's warmth, you know, there, but having that type of mindset with a tree, you know, is a different level that not everyone, you know, some people think you're getting pretty esoteric there, but you can, it definitely can happen. And, you know, the being in a forest and the chemicals that they release, that it does affect you that way. Like the way a dog looks at you, or, you know, the smell of a horse's muzzle, or, you know, elephants are powerful that way. Just their look when they look you in the eye, you know, like there's something energetically or spiritual about it. And, you know, you got to be open to it. Again, it goes right back to the openness, right? And you can just shut it down and say, you know, we're a bunch of crazy, ignorant tree huggers or whatever, but that's just a place that people are at, right? And I may have been at that place myself in the early days. I was about getting it done and cutting, and there was a whole other mindset, you know, and I've shifted into a different way of thinking. And if I can be an example of that, then great.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think maybe for you, Duane, but definitely for me, sobriety has been a huge part of that too, allowing that major connection to get expanded in big ways that I never knew was possible. You know, now that there's a lot more clarity in my brain on a daily basis, it's just, it opens up so much more space for connection, whether it's with my dog or with the people that I'm with, or God, in the forest. Oh my God, have you all ever went up to an old growth tree and put your hand on it and just felt like you could feel the energy of the entire earth pumping into your soul? Like, that's what I feel when I am among those old ancient trees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to have nothing altering or creating a pseudo or false representation of that, you know, and I think for me, that's, you know, substances, alcohol particularly, you know, brought, you know, they're, I've heard it said that they were called spirits in the beginning for a reason. And it gave you an artificial sense of what being spiritually connected is. And that's why they was called spirits. And you can actually get the feeling that some of us get when we drink. You can actually get that for real and in a healthy way if you nurture and develop that. And unfortunately, alcohol can lube some people into that, so to speak. But for some of us, it becomes a replacement rather than a way to give you a glimpse into what's possible. And we take it too far. So, when you don't have that corruption in there, or that, you know, it's like really seeing, you can take the lens, the glasses off and see with real eyes, sort of thing.
Exactly. Exactly. And that feeling of connection lasts so much longer and feels so much more profound. You know, I think I got that a lot when I was drinking, but it wouldn't last that long. You know, you wake up with a hangover and that connection is gone.
Well, you'd be, you know, the craving and the obsession of the mind to recreate it over and over, right, is part of what happens.
Right. Totally. Yeah. And I.
And it's a whole other thing that's relatively prevalent in the industry.
For sure.
At Absolutely. Least for some of us.
Yeah. And I think that I get that sometimes too with being in the big forests, right? Like, I get that craving for recreating that feeling, but it's in such a different way. It's in a way of like, that felt so amazing and so connected. I would like to have more of that feeling and more of that energy, you know, and more of that connection. And there's just nothing like that. Climbing in the giant sequoias changed my brain in a way that I don't think I can ever come back from.
Cool. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Wow, it's been a long chat, Tony. We've surpassed our I think this may be our longest one now officially.
I don't know. I don't really keep track. It's longer than usual, but I don't really keep track.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's been good. And there you go. That's what happens when you let the river flow. You were mentioning, and I've made the river metaphor a couple times because I do know that you have an affinity and a background in whitewater, correct?
Oh, yeah. I love being on the river. Yeah, I haven't spent that much time on the river in the last year or so because it's been a little bit of a crazy 2023 was a little bit crazy for me in a lot of major life changes sort of way. But outside of that, yeah, I've spent a lot of time on the river, and the lessons that I learn on the river, I think are often as profound as the lessons that I learn in those big trees. And much of that is just letting it flow, like you said, you know, and it's such a profound experience of being on a powerful whitewater river. I've had the opportunity to row a boat down the Grand Canyon, the Colorado River, through the Grand Canyon 2 times now, and on other big, amazing rivers. And there's nothing in the world that makes you feel so small as when you, but in a beautiful, good way, not small as in like, oh, I don't matter, but small as in like the world is so expansive, you know, and nature is so powerful and magnificent. And being able to row a boat down those insanely giant rapids on such a big river, when you look side to side, you know, there are points in that canyon that it's massive, you know, and the waves can be the size of houses, and you're just on this little boat going up and up and up and up and then down and down and down and down, and the holes are massive too, and it's just extremely exhilarating. And the lessons that I learn in those spaces are incredible. And then looking up at the stars through this little slit in a canyon and seeing just more stars than I've ever seen in my life, you just feel so tiny. And I think that those experiences are so important in life to make you feel small and understand that you're just a little speck. And in the world of trees too, you know, we're just this little blip in time to a 3,000-year-old giant sequoia. We're just a little speck. And they have seen so much. Yeah, I love whitewater. That's a good time. We still got to get out on a boat, Dwayne.
Yeah. It'll happen. It'll happen. We'll do it. Yes.
It's really fun. I've been, I don't know if it's age or what, but I've been running less significant whitewater over the last handful of years. Used to be all into class 5 and get fired up about that. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know, running some class 3s, perfectly happy and acceptable with me.
Yeah.
Maybe a little less of an adrenaline junkie than I used to be.
I think part of it might be too, maybe it just comes with age, but you know, that feeling you're describing of being small could be labeled as having a sense of awe. And you know, there's scientific research that says, you know, if you want to go that route, that, you know, that feeling of a sense of awe is a key thing to general happiness and fulfillment in life. But back to the age thing, I think that when you're younger with less experience in life, it's harder to find that sense of awe. But as you get a little older, get more experience, it's a little bit easier to find that sense of awe. Like, you can find it next to a 3,000-year-old sequoia. I can find it next to a 60-year-old oak tree too, right? Yeah. It's just, you know, it. But that only comes with time. Yeah. You know, when I was 21, I couldn't have found any awe anywhere without doing something crazy, you know, by cultural standards, right? You know. had to suffer from testosterone poisoning to find that sense of awe. Now yeah. I can find it in the smaller things, right?
Yeah. And you
say it comes from getting old, but I think it comes from seeing the world differently, which is sort of is not mutually exclusive. It's in part of. I don't think when I was 21, I had enough experience to understand it and see it. And now that I'm far from 21, I do have the understanding and the experience to see it because I've seen it so many times. It was thrown in my face so many times. It just took me that 1,000 times thrown in my face. So I'm like, ah, son of a bitch. There it is.
Yeah.
See it now.
Right. Yeah. But I love the way you said that. That's exactly right. I mean, I feel like I need less of those super high powered adrenaline experiences because I find it every day. I find it on a walk with my dog and looking at the changing leaves or the flowers, or just pick up a cone and notice different parts of it that I never noticed before. You know, just everyday moments are bringing more of a sense of awe than they used to. And that's I'm finding a hard time like grappling with that, I guess. I'm 37. And so I feel like I'm older than I should be in some ways, both physically and other ways too. And just, I'm having a hard time like wrestling with not needing those experiences so much. And, you know, maybe part of that is from sobriety too. You know, maybe that's like, I'm getting more joy out of different things that I never did before.
You know, I think it's again, the forestry model concept, the human forest, you know, like when you're growing up in the forest and you're young and vibrant, high dynamic energy, you know, lots of stretch and strength and you're out, you know, but when you're growing up through it, getting taller, getting stronger, then, you know, storms come, a tree falls against you, you know, you get some bark ripped off, maybe a branch tears, you know, then as you grow older, you poke out and you can start to see the expanse of where you came from and what you're part of and those that are coming where you were before, but you can't see it until your canopy extends out beyond the rest of the forest, right? And, you know, what another example of these old trees, right? They're just, what the wisdom they can't help but impart it. They've just simply seen it and experienced it. And, you know, I wonder if they could think like, why are they the ones that survived after all the trees that they were part of when they were young to, you know, they didn't all get that old, only some, you know, it's like any forest, not everybody gets the luxury or the gift of being the old big tree, you know, and why that is, that's just life. You know, it's not they didn't deserve it any more than anyone else. You know, it's just the way it worked out and having the grace to accept that. And, you know, some of those trees fell sooner than others. And, but even in that, they're giving back, right? They're giving back to the forest, giving back to the forest. A log provides all sorts of habitat and nurse benefits to everything. You know, it's just such an amazing cycle. And, I think that's where when you talk about getting older, you know, your canopy is extending out and your vision expands. You can see more. I remember climbing that Sitka in 2006 or whenever that was when we did the Boga Trail. And when I poked out, I think I was second or third up the tree. And I was going up on Mar Bars, which, man, there's definitely easier ways than that, but I did it. And I got up and they were good, but when I went up past, I mean, one thing was looking beside me and seeing a diameter that I couldn't see around. Like, I couldn't see around the trunk, right? So, like, I wouldn't even have been able to talk to someone on the other side of the trunk of that tree. And I'm above the canopy of all the rest of the trees. And then looking up, I'm still a yelling distance away from the guys that are in the tree, in the canopy of the very tree I'm ascending, right? And it's like, this is just wild. And, you know, there was only a... You know, there's not a lot of those trees around, but there's always going to be them. There's a cycle, you know, there's always going to be these big trees. They're just going to show up in a little different place, but it's just, it's really, really interesting. And that was an experience that I'll never forget. And I often think back on that and in reflection of my own life. And where I'm at in that climb, you know. And when James passed, you know, he talked about that in one of my last conversations with him, you know, that his ascent into the canopy of the hereafter. Like, that was his example of, like, he was climbing into the afterlife, right? The tree of life. And he was about to ascend into the canopy, right? And what a neat metaphor, you know?
Yeah. And James was this kind of person that just reminded me of an old growth tree, the feeling that you got when you were around him. And the last time that I saw him was, we had done an aerial rescue class at Miller Sylvania State Park, and I was with him and Tyler, and we went over and looked at some of the old trees in that park that when I had worked for parks, we put this fencing and some low growing native veg around them so that it could provide a space for them to age and shed their branches naturally and just exist without, you know, reducing compaction and stuff. And so showed them those trees and, you know, that feeling of like putting your hand on an old growth tree and getting so energized, like I mentioned before, that's the feeling that I always got around James, was that like, oh my God, he just energizes you and makes you feel like you're tapping into this battery and connection. And he's an amazing human being. We miss much.
And there's an example of, you know, his legacy, or his, you know, his fallen tree, so to speak, is still clear, like very much a part of the forest as we know it, and I think will be for many years to come. Just like the trunk of a large tree that falls and is in the forest for everyone to stop, admire, and appreciate, even in that state, you know, and his legacy is living on in that way, big time.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great example. Yeah, there. Whether you're a tree or an amazing human being in this world, we don't just go away when we die, right? We provide so much support and legacy and become the soil, right, that other trees and people get to grow from.
Yep, exactly. It germinates, like he's germinating. His legacy will germinate many seeds.
Yeah, absolutely.
For years to come. Yeah, I know. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, really cool. Yeah, absolutely. I think of my brother in that way very much. Passed away about 7 months ago. And just the legacy that he left, he was doing amazing things with that big brain of his. And just like incredible work that will continue to fuel what we learn about energy and many other processes. He was an incredible engineering brain, and we leave a lot in this world, and we can only hope to leave as much good as those guys.
Yep. Inspiration is good.
Yeah. It is. You all inspire me.
Well, thanks.
We try, at least with bad humor.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we took the time to, and we also reserve the right, or we're always open to do overs and to second takes and to re-record, not re-recording, but another recording, I think.